Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? In 2015, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO for short, discovered the first evidence for gravitational waves, which resulted for a merger between two black holes. Now, this was a monumental event because ultimately it provided, again, evidence for one of the predictions of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Now, since then, we've had many detections of gravitational waves, not only black holes, but also neutron stars. And this has opened up a whole area of research because these particular gravitational wave detections allows a better understanding of basically what these events are involved with merger of particular black holes and neutron stars, but also from other electromagnetic radiation that comes off these events, we have a deeper understanding of the astrophysics principles at play. My guest today, Jackie Bondal, is the Educational Outreach and Coordinator of OSGRAV. Now, OSGRAV is the ARC Centre of Excellence for Gravitational Wave Discovery. And not only that, she's also the coordinator for the Centre of Excellence for Dark Matter as well. And in essence, what she does is she produces programs for outreach for the general public, but also for resources for educators and in turn, students to have a deeper understanding of these events, but also create a passion for the science that is involved with gravitational waves and dark matter. Not only that, she's also a passionate science communicator, and in particular, she has a passion for increasing STEM uptake in female students and also underrepresented students, such as students in rural and in regional areas in Australia. Welcome, Jackie.
Ah, thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what you do currently in terms of your role in terms of the ARC Centre of Excellence.
So I find my position almost as a liaison. So we have at the universities these researchers doing this wonderful, exciting science. I mean, who doesn't hear about gravitational waves and dark matter and thinks, wow, that's really cool. And you know, teachers are so, you know, keen to try to incorporate that into their classes. But, you know, as a former teacher and as a teacher, you know that, you know, the last thing we have is a lot of time. And so what, you know, I get to do is I get to essentially translate that research into, you know, curriculum aligned activities and programs that teachers can incorporate into their classrooms that we can deliver in conjunction with our scientists to students, and also, you know, activities for general public engagement. So, you know, I get to kind of take all this fun science and filter it in a way that is, you know, is relevant for the, you know, classroom and really hopefully useful for teachers.
Now, this is a really new area of discovery, really. I mean, as I said, 2015 was the first detection of gravitational waves. What led you to go into gravitational waves? I mean, you were teaching for 15 years and clearly you decided to do something different. What was it about gravitational waves that piqued your interest?
Well, it was, you know, as a physics teacher, it was, you know, I always kind of kept ahead, you know, tried to stay at the cutting edge of, you know, what was happening. And, you know, I'll be honest, you know, it was always, you know, my students who would be incredibly interested and come to me with all these new, you know, new discoveries in science. But honestly, what led me to, you know, focus in on this work with OSGRAV was relocating to Australia from the US. It was, you know, it was a two-body problem where my, partner, it was recruited for a position here in Australia. And if we wanted to make the move, I had to find work. And I had been teaching for a long time and I, you know, loved being in the classroom, but this opportunity, so OSGRAV was just launching as a center at the same time that I was relocating over here. And it was, you know, this great opportunity to, that they had this position for someone who would, you know, work, you know, as this, you know, over this bridge between the research and the classroom. And I felt like my sort of science background and my, teaching experience made me a good fit for it. And yeah, it was really, it was really, the opportunity that came to me. And if I must be, to be perfectly honest.
Tell us a little bit about Ausgrav. Now, LIGO, of course, is based in Washington and also, of course, in Louisiana. So it's a very American-based. I know that there's also Virgo in it's Italy as well in terms of detection of gravitational wave. What is it special about, like, Australia to have Ausgrav?
Okay. So Ausgrav is part of the larger, what we call the LVK collaboration. So LVK meaning LIGO, Virgo, KAGRA. So with LIGO being the US-based detectors, Virgo being the European-based detector, and KAGRA now the Japanese-based detector. So, so gravitational wave science has always been, very international. We've had scientists in Australia, working on gravitational waves for, for decades now. So Australians have always been part of the larger collaboration. So it's not just, strictly, US based. They have scientists all over the world. So Ausgrav is one of the members of this larger collaboration. And so Ausgrav itself has researchers from six different universities. So it's an umbrella organization that has essentially served as a way to bring together all the gravitation, instrumentation, multi-messenger astronomy scientists working within Australia under one umbrella, so that, to really allow for a lot of that cross collaboration. And then in turn, that, collaboration between us and the larger international network of researchers. So I think it's, every organization in the LVK is going to have its area, which it, tends to, do a lot of, research in, and tends to have its, certain niche areas. And Australia is quite the, is definitely one of the leaders in a lot of areas of gravitational wave science with, we have, some amazing labs here doing instrumentation work. So actually building the instruments and a lot of the devices that go into the interferometers. We've got, a supercomputers here. So we do a lot with the data management and understanding how we actually work with all the data that comes in from the detectors. And then we also have, people working in, stellar remnants, black holes, neutron stars, pulsars, and working in those areas. So yeah, it's been by getting everyone under one umbrella, it's great opportunity to actually foster some of that creative collaboration that might not have been as easily accessible.
Tell us a little bit about your day-to-day. So currently, what are you working on, and give us a bit of an insight of what you are doing at the moment?
Sure. So one thing that we've been working on for and delivering for a couple of years is incorporating interactive visualization, such as virtual reality, into curriculum aligned programs for teachers and schools. Because one of the things with gravitational waves is that, and even black holes, neutron stars, anything, honestly, so many things astrophysics based, is that visualization is so important, but also, hard to do, especially in the context of a classroom. So, we have such great, we have people on staff and with our organizations that are excellent at developing, VR interfaces and actually doing a lot of that design. So we thought that we would kind of take that strength and combine it with content that would be accessible to high school students. So we developed a whole program around stellar evolution that we deliver as an incursion and offer all of our resources to teachers for free. And that's been great. We've got a lot of great pickup with it, really good feedback. So what we're doing now is we are got, two big projects with Ausgrav that we're going to be developing this year. The first one is kind of the next stage of the visualization project, which is to do focus a little bit more on the gravitation piece. So we're developing a virtual gravity playground. I think our working name is Gravity Explorer. Yeah, but the idea is that it's this virtual space where students can perform, you know, experiments, you know, related to understanding gravitational fields on the surfaces. You know, your monkey hunter experiment. You've got a pendula, so essentially a gravity playground, and where you can change parameters with, you know, masses and sizes and gravitational field strength to, you know, essentially create a, you know, virtual lab experience. And then, you know, we have, you know, from there, the idea is that they then go to a mystery planet, like they travel virtually through space. And then, you know, based on what they learned in their experimental phase, they have to apply that and to try to learn all they can about this mystery place in space. So whether that mystery place in space is near a black hole or, you know, in, you know, a microgravity environment or on a planet, the idea is that, you know, they have this virtual, you know, exploratorium for gravity. So that's, you know, that's coming along really well. Hopefully we'll be piloting that with schools and teachers by mid-year. And then because in addition to all the astrophysics, OSGRAV researchers also do a lot of work with instrumentation, you know, building the detectors, as well as dealing with the data. So we're working to develop some activities for schools that focus more on the instrumentation piece. So trying to make, so all of the LIGO data is publicly available, but it's not exactly in the easiest form for a lot of students to deal with. So we're investigating ways in which we can try to develop some, you know, interfaces with more friendly block coding possibilities to allow students to work with that data at a, you know, without needing a lot of the higher level mathematics and programming skills that you might need otherwise. So we sort of have some data activities as well as, and we're going to work with our instrumentation people to try to make that as, you know, kind of incorporate that data piece with some hands-on instrumentation activities.
Now, your area is also, as you mentioned before, in terms of dark matter, which is a sort of a nice synergy, because dark matter is really particle physics, but at the same time, it's about understanding cosmological principles as well. What is that something that you decided to go into, or is it like tapped you on the shoulder?
I was tapped on the shoulder, yeah. Well, because there are some overlap with the universities and the researchers in the various institutes. So one of my colleagues from who's involved with actively with outreach with OSGRAV is also chief investigator for the Dark Matter Center. So he tapped me on the shoulder, and because he had seen that we had developed a lot of good educational programs with OSGRAV and thought, you know, we could do some really interesting things with the Dark Matter Center. So with that, so our goal with the Dark Matter Center is, you know, we're still going to do a lot of the development of, you know, try to come up with some creative activities and build on some of the activities that our colleagues at places like CERN and Perimeter Institute and Sanford Underground Lab have done, but to also develop some of our, you know, work with our early career researchers to develop, you know, some student-friendly activities. But the one thing that's really exciting about the Dark Matter Education Program is we are starting a system of partner schools. And with these partner schools, we are looking to have a long-term relationship with them, in which we will work with the same school over 5, 6, 7 years of the center, so that we'll see the same students when they're in year 7 and then when they're in year 8 and when they're in year 9, to try to increase the, you know, pipeline of students coming from regional and rural areas of Australia. So our pilot school that we're working with is Stawell in Victoria. And the reason for Stawell is because in the one of the old gold mines in Stawell, we are building Australia's first underground dark matter lab.
Wow.
And in Stawell. So we're working with the government secondary school there And the idea is that over the course of the year, we'll have multiple touch points in which we bring in our researchers and do science-based activities. We are going to bring in artists to do science and art workshops. And we're also going to be working with the Design Factory Melbourne to do innovation workshops. And the idea is that, you know, we're piloting this with one school, but the idea is to build a network of partner schools, which we engage with over the longer term to, again, really increase that pipeline of students coming from regional areas into, you know, some area of tertiary STEM. So, yeah, so lots of things going on. It was, really exciting. Yeah, it's a really exciting time to bring, like, you know, this cutting edge science, which Australians are doing in, like, you know, all across the country and in regional areas, and bring, you know, that science to, you know, teachers and students and get them, you know, excited about it.
Now, change of tack, I guess I want to make you the focus more than just the science. What got you into science education, particularly physics?
I think maybe for like a brief time when I was growing up, I thought I wanted to, I liked astronomy, and, you know, I had the star stickers on my ceiling in my bedroom growing up. What kid doesn't? But I wasn't planning on going physics. I didn't do physics in secondary. And I went to university and I was focusing on getting into physical therapy and athletic training. And then I realized I was pretty bad at biology. I was just not feeling passionate about, you know, about the work. But as a health science major, you had to take a physics requirement. And I took the required physics course, and wow, it just made sense to me. It just, you know, something about it clicked, and I found out the university had a, you know, physics and astronomy major. And after my first year, I switched into physics. But I always, you know, but even while I was doing that, I was an undergraduate teaching assistant, and I always enjoyed the education piece. So I finished my university degree, and I was kind of torn, like, whether I wanted to go to graduate school for physics or go straight into teaching. I think I knew I eventually wanted to get into teaching, but I was offered a scholarship to go into graduate, you know, to do some, you know, post-bac studies. And so I did a few more years, got my master's, and, you know, was again debating, like, now, do I want to go teach or do I want to stay on for my PhD? And at the time, I was feeling a little isolated in my PhD studies, which, you know, it's fine. It just wasn't the right place at the right time. So I pivoted into teaching. So I kind of had that, you know, solid science background that allowed me, and then the, you know, experience, you know, some experience teaching. So I was able to, you know, pivot that into going into education. And then I didn't even realize it. My father, his career was as a business professor, at a local university. And only once I switched into being a physics major did he tell me, he's like, oh, I was a physics major at university. I'm like, yeah, what? You know, but you're a business professor. Like, why did I never know this? But, you know, apparently at the time that he was, you know, going to university, it was, you know, the time of Sputnik and the space race. And it was, you know, it was the science, you know, it was the major to study at the time. So, like, everyone was a physics major, like, all of his friends were physics majors at the time. Obviously, it didn't stick for him, but he, so I guess, yeah, there was that sort of, you know, little, you know, connection, but I didn't realize it until after I made the decision to go into physics.
Now, you were a teacher for physics for 15 years, and then, of course, yes, as you mentioned earlier, you moved to Australia. Was it an active decision to leave teaching and go in to do what with Ausgrav, or was it simply the job opportunity that came across for you?
I thought at the time I wanted to see what else was, what else I could do with my background. I love the classroom. I love teaching. You know, I had lots of opportunities, but, you know, where I was, it was such a, you know, wonderful place to teach, and it was one of the, you know, the top schools in the U.S. and, you know, But just like, I always tell my students to, don't limit yourself to what you're doing. Think about what you could do. Is that kind of that same idea? I'm like, I love what I'm doing, but I'm also open to looking at other things. And I also thought that, moving to another country, there would just be a whole level of complexity with getting the appropriate teaching credentials to, be in the schools here. So it was, so those kind of helped me, make that decision to jump into something a little bit new.
Do you miss the classroom?
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't miss the marking, but I do miss the classroom, which is, and I do get to go in and run programs with students, which is, which is still one of my favorite things to do. Yeah, that's one of, the definite perks of my, getting to go in and, work with classrooms and, get back into working with students. But then I get to like send them back to their teachers and I don't have to mark any of their stuff. So
it's like the old proverbial grandparent saying, I love this baby, but I can give it back to my.
Oh, totally. Yeah. 100%. But yeah, and then, I really love the opportunity to work with teachers because at least I know that, I'm still trying to stay connected to the classroom and, ideally it helps me stay current with what, some of the issues that teachers are experiencing and, just be a friend and a partner to teachers.
Did you have to do much preparation and training to get into your role? I would imagine all of a sudden the depth of complexity of understanding gravitational waves and now dark matter has put you into the deep end. That wasn't your PhD, I assume. So therefore, was there an active training or just simply reading on the job?
A lot of reading on the job. Yeah. And asking lots of questions because I'm embedded with a lot of, all the offices around me are researchers. So, they come with, great ideas and I can ask them my questions. I mean, so for the, our stellar evolution, kind of where do black holes and neutron stars come from lessons, all of the program that went into that virtual interface, that was from the research of one of our, the code developed by, one of our researchers, so there's, so it's a lot of learning on the job.
What I really like about what you just shared was the fact that your path to, in terms of science, wasn't set when you were in high school. And really that the message already, which I constantly get in all the interviews I've had so far, is that it's okay to not know exactly what you're doing. There are so many opportunities that come your way at various stages of your career that lead you down to different paths. And I find that really fascinating, the fact that your path hasn't been a direct from A to B. It's gone multiple different directions and directions you weren't expecting.
Yeah. And, part of it is just, sometimes when an unexpected opportunity comes your way, just taking the plunge and saying yes. And that's, that's how we ended up here in Australia. And that's how I ended up with Ausgrav. And, I remember, I was probably 12 years into my teaching career. And the assistant, where I taught, we had our, face-to-face program, but we also, because I was in North Carolina, which has a very large rural population. And so we also offered distance education courses, free of charge for class, for students in all parts of the state that they would, be able to take during their school day. And the person who was teaching the distance education physics course, had relocated and they needed, someone from the face-to-face program to step in and teach a couple of the, remote courses. And it was like, you kind of see this sometimes where, you have people lined up and they ask for a volunteer and like everybody but one person steps back. So it was kind of one of those situations. I'm like, oh, I don't want to teach, It's like, I don't want to teach from a studio and, have to use, green screens and like all this new technology, which I don't know how to use. So reluctantly, I said, okay, well, if no one else will, I'll do it. And my assistant principal, she's, she really helped me reframe it instead of it being something that I was just, you know, going to go in and just kind of, you know, tolerate and get it done. She's like, look at this as a growth experience. Look at how much, you know, I want to talk to you in a year and see where you, you know, where you are. Because if you, you know, look at this as a growth experience, think about how much you're going to learn about how to effectively teach through different media and how to, you know, take what, you know, you currently do well into this new format. And, you know, kind of once I sort of had that little mindset shift, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, let me take advantage of professional development. Let me just, you know, dive in again. Let me ask the questions of everyone that, you know, the other people that have done it. And yeah, sometimes it's just kind of saying, you know, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to grow from it. I don't know where it's going to take me. But, you know, if I, you know, I learn something new from it, then, you know, it'll have been worth the experience.
Onto science communication, that's another thing that you're really passionate about. Your role, particularly with OSGRAV, is about communicating gravitational waves and dark matter. Why is it important?
Yeah, this is, you know, I have plenty, you know, when we work with the public, plenty of people ask them the same thing, like, why should I care about, you know, about gravitational waves? So from the perspective of, you know, science communication, it's, you know, from my perspective, it's, you know, trying to give people an, you know, feel an emotional connection to, you know, to the science and what's new, and, you know, feeling an emotional connection to exploring and asking questions and seeking evidence, you know, not just taking, you know, things, you know, as they are because that's the way they are. You know, that's, you know, we thought physics was dead in 1900 and then, you know, we thought we had learned it all, and then look at where we are now. You know, so just, so just from the science communication perspective, you know, I want to try to build that connection with them so that they, you know, don't need to, you know, love the topic. They don't even need to understand everything about the topic, but, you know, to understand why, you know, science is a noble, is a useful pursuit for society, you know, and for moving society forward. Specifically with gravitational waves, we talk about how, I talk about how pure research is often the thing that drives forward innovation technology and, you know, what we use day to day, you know. So, you know, things like the, you know, World Wide Web, you know, was developed as a way for scientists at CERN to communicate with each other, and look at where we are with it now. So that, you know, there's so many, you know, translations of that research into our life that, you know, they're innumerable, you know. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, someone's curiosity and pure research is going to provide some betterment down the road. So like with, you know, with our researchers at OSGRAV, we do have some of our researchers that have gone and, you know, developed their own startups, and, you know, a group that has turned technology for developing space-based interferometers into a ground sensing device that can do early earthquake detection. Some of the instrumentation is now used as a technology in self-driving cars. So it's one of these things where you don't, you know, study, you know, gravitational wave, you don't, you know, study gravitational wave research to, you know, to improve the world with self-driving cars, but, you know, it's that, you know, getting, you know, these great, you know, creative, diverse thinkers, you know, trying to solve science problems, most of the time they don't have the technology that they need to do what they want to do. So they have to develop it. You know, when they start design LIGO, they didn't, you know, have the technology they needed to make it work didn't exist. But that's, you know, the idea is that, you know, you're using science as a way to drive that creativity. And it also brings intelligent, you know, driven, you know, people into your local communities, and it brings up the entire community when you have, you know, scientists in it.
I think what you said right at the beginning is that your role is to allow people have an emotional reaction, an emotional connection to what you're doing. And I think that's why astrophysics has it so easy, because it's in one sense, creates a sense of awe, but also a sense of, oh my goodness, we're so insignificant in just purely the physical universe and so forth. And it has it invokes an emotional connection. Same with black holes. When you talk about the, you know, the black hole, for example, M87, which of course is, you know, when you think of the size of that, it just, it's amazing. And obviously the black holes that emerged are not exactly dwarfs either. And I think really what you're doing, and I'm sure you are doing it, and a good science communicator is doing, and we think of David Attenborough and other people who are in the other fields, chemistry, biology, they're actually invoking an emotional reaction because it allows us to get a sense of the place of the world that we are in. You know, where is that? Where's my place in this universe?
Yeah.
Going on to students. So we got a student who is, I mean, I'm leaving this pretty open. So if you have a student who's possibly exploring, should I do a science degree? Should I explore science? What do I need to do to do well in science? What advice would you give them?
You know, step one, you just have to be interested in it. You know, it's, you know, you're not gonna, you know, science, you know, is fascinating, but it's not trivial, and, you know, it does require work to understand it. But if you have enough interest, then that work, you know, will be, you know, it won't be as steep of a hill with that work. So, you know, find what you're interested in. You don't necessarily know where it will take you, but any kind of, you know, STEM degree will, you know, set you up with a lot of choice. You know, find something that you enjoy, and then, you know, when you have your degree, you can reevaluate. And the skills that you develop through STEM, you know, your inquiry skills, your ability to develop and ask questions, to, you know, look for evidence and build, you know, build your case. That's applicable across, you know, whatever it is that you want to do. So when I was teaching in the US, we had a lot of students who would have, you know, pressure from their families to go to medical school or something like that. But they're really interested in physics, and they would have a lot of pushback from their families to, like the students would want to study, say, physics at university. And they would have a lot of pushback from their families, like, no, you need to do biology because we expect you to go to medical school. We expect, you know, or you want to go to medical school, but, and, you know, the truth is that there's a entrance exam for medical school in the US called the MCAT. And statistically, students who major in physics do the best on the MCAT. And, you know, so, you know, being, you know, kind of follow, you know, if you're into STEM, following the science that you, you know, that you're passionate about, and then, you know, it could still take you, you know, so many different places. So you don't have to know exactly what you want to do. You know, find what you enjoy, surround yourself with, you know, people that you enjoy working with, look for mentors, you know, in your degree to help you stay passionate, to help you along the way. And, you know, then when you get to a pivot point, say after you graduate, you know, the world opens up for you again. Your skill set can take you anywhere.
Now, you are a female scientist, female communicator in a, statistically speaking, male-dominated field, particularly physics, and you clearly have a passion of increasing STEM uptake in female students. What advice would you give to the female students who are considering a career in or at least study in physics?
Yep. Sometimes you're going to be a minority in that room, you know, often. And, you know, you need to, but that doesn't mean that your voice, you know, can't be heard. So I would, you know, give the advice to, you know, obviously, like what I would say to anyone, you know, find your passion, but look for, you know, the mentors and, you know, the role models, and look for the allies, you know, work with, you know, if, you know, you're working with, you know, doing group work, it's, you know, the, in your classes, you know, try to find the people that, you know, value your voice and value what you're going to say. You know, you don't have to, work with, you don't have to, work with everyone all the time. You can find, your group that, that lifts you, and to, find those allies and, find those people that resonate with you. And I mean, honestly, getting a physics degree was hard for me. Like, being a physicist was not natural. It didn't feel natural, but I was really interested in it. But I found myself a, core group of people that, we could study together, we could assist each other, we would support each other. And, and it was mixed, males, female, any, all different backgrounds. And, we sort of found each other, and, we supported each other. And, I think it's, it's really finding your tribe, finding your people that, can help you lift your voice.
My final question to you is a little bit more lighthearted. It's an opportunity for you to share something that you're really passionate about that doesn't necessarily have to be a science or physics-y topic. Maybe it's something that you're nerding about, something that you would open your mouth in mixed company when you first had the first opportunity to speak. What would you like to share with us?
Since, I was 15, I have been a rower. So I loved sports growing up, and I was pretty bad at most sports growing up. But I grew up near Philadelphia, which is a bit of a rowing hub in the U.S. And I have four older brothers, and they all rowed before me. And I said, I am never going to row, because that's what people expected me to do. Like, I'm never going to do this. And finally, I tried it. And like, it was kind of like how I fell into physics. I fell into rowing. I'm like, I like this. This is good. And it was one of those sports that didn't require hand-eye coordination for, that you needed to like hit, kick, or throw a ball. It didn't require, you to run fast, because I'm not a fast runner. It didn't, so there was, so I kind of, fell into that. And, I used to joke at university, I got a rowing degree with, a physics minor, because I felt like I, put in so much time into, into my sport. And I've, stayed on and off with it. And I've been a coach, and I've taught Learn to Row. And, now I've gotten back into it as a master's, which means old rower, which, once you get to a certain age, you're considered a master's. So I kind of, and I found myself here in Australia in, around Melbourne, with being in another rowing hub.
Yeah.
So I've kind of come full circle from, the hub in the US to the hub here on the Yarra. And, obviously there's some, some physics involved with it, like with any sport. But man, I just, given the choice of, what to do on a, for a training day, or what to do on a, an afternoon, I'm going to go row. I'm going to a regatta this weekend. I've got another regatta this weekend. It's kind of, been a big passion of mine for most of my life.
So fill us in a little bit about rowing, because it's not just rowing. I mean, you've got your single sculls and your quad sculls and so forth. What do you prefer?
Well, I've pretty much raced in every combination of every type of boat that there is, once you, row for long enough. So there's sweep rowing, in which each rower has one bigger oar just on one side of the boat, and that, they alternate. And then there's sculling, in which each person has two oars, so one out on either side of the boat. So you can do sweep rowing, or you can do sculling, and you can do, alternate between the two. You can't do both in the same boat at the same time, but that wouldn't work very well. And so at university in the US, it was all mostly sweep rowing, bigger boats like eights and fours, though the first thing I learned to row was a single, sculling single. So it's, and right now with my club, I'm racing anything from a single to an eight, and everything in between. So the mixing and matching with, new rowers, experienced rowers, there's, mixed boats with men, women, old, young, and so it's, and then finally last year for the, before lockdown, my brother was here visiting from the US. We got to, for the first time in our lives since we were teenagers, we got to row together. Yes. Cause, he's still involved in coaching and rowing as well, but on the other side of the world in the US. So now we're both we're both in the same place at the same time and wanting to do the same thing. So yeah, it's a sport that was, commonly associated with, the elite in, initially in the US and in the UK. You had your Cambridge, Oxford races. In the US, you have your Yales and your Harvards. But there's been a big growth in it in the US, where it's due to trying to balance out the numbers in American football teams to have equity for female athletes. A lot more universities have introduced women's rowing in the US. So it's really taken off in the US. I was when I was in university, it was like right at the start of when that transition was happening. Still rowing, but it's been this like elitist sport. And, because it's grown a lot in the US, it's become something that's, more students have access to and more people from diverse backgrounds have access to. Maybe that's something it does have in common with physics, is that, hopefully over time we find, find a way to make, make these opportunities more equitable.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's a really different thing. It's what I like is you actually showed exactly you're nerding about, because you just couldn't stop talking about it, which is great.
You can cut out half of that if you need to.
No, not at all. Not at all. That's fantastic. Well, Jackie, it's been wonderful talking with you to get a bit inside of your work, and particularly I've been fascinated about your particular work with Ausgrav, and I will ensure I will put the links to Ausgrav and therefore also the resources and the future resources as well for you to access. And if you're watching or if you're listening to this via the podcast, again, check my Physics High website. I'll make sure the links are available there as well. Jackie, thanks again for your time, and take care. Bye for now.
All right. Thank you. Good night, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.